Thank you, Don. It's 10:11. This is John Williams back from a tour of France with a bunch of WGN radio listeners. It's 10:11. Thanks to everybody that filled in for me last Saturday and the past couple of weeks. We were, Brenda and I, gone with some of you for about 10-11 days. It was a really nice trip. It's also good to be back in the studio. So as not to just go on and on about my trip because you weren't there, let me just give you one highlight and then we'll move on. We did Paris to Normandy with stops in Rouen and Giverny and some of these French cities that I'd never heard of before. We saw the Eiffel Tower twinkling at night and Monet's house and garden by day. It was a trip that was even more memorable for Brenda and me since we had so many good friends and previous travelers. Shout out to you all with us. And since my brother and sister-in-law were with us as well. My brother Mark's first day of retirement came on that trip. And that night we clinked glasses of wine to celebrate the moment. And then I kissed my brother on the cheek, a moment that was captured by one of us on their camera phone and later shared with me. And so I thought, well, I will share that moment with our father. So I texted it to my dad in my contacts. He's DAD. Next to DAD in my contacts list is a guy I really don't know that well named DAVE, Dave. And I accidentally sent the photo of me planting one on Mark's cheek to Dave instead of Dad. And Dave doesn't know Mark. And he really doesn't know me that well. So he got the picture of me kissing this 6'4" man from Paris. Moments later, Dave texted back, wrong recipient. The most memorable part of the trip, of course, was the stops in Normandy at both Omaha and Utah beaches. 75 years ago this summer, I know we all know, British, Canadian, and American forces landed there. And our first stop at Omaha was, I was told, the same spot that you recall in the opening scene of Saving Private Ryan. That beach is still, of course, long and, depending on the tide, very wide. It runs, as you might imagine, directly to a bluff. And when you stand there on the very sands that those thousands of men died on, you sense how daring and desperate their charge was. There's a sculpture there, but very little of the hardware from the battle remains. You don't see bunkers or machine guns or cannons. You'll find them scattered in some spots, but that's not part of the Omaha scene. And that disappointed a couple of guys in our group. They wanted to see some of the machinery of war, but for me, the vast stretch of sand was a monument in itself. And the idea that with 70 pounds on my back as a 22-year-old, I would jump off a boat into the water and walk under machine gun fire as men dropped left and right was more wrenching than any concrete or steel. It gives you pause. We were told that the French wanted the steel back anyway, for other purposes. So those guns were removed and melted and reused, and who wants to keep monuments to an occupying army anyway? And then we went to the cemetery, and there's a long reflecting pool before the immaculate lawns of white crosses. Incidentally, when you see, or if you can just imagine those endless rows of perfectly aligned white crosses, know that 61% of the American soldiers that died there, their remains and crosses are actually back in the United States. 39% of the families had their sons' bodies buried there, but it's just a fraction then of the total loss that day. At the cemetery, there's this long reflecting pool, and there's another statue. Two women in our group volunteered to lay flowers at the statue's base in a brief ceremony. And then the 100-plus of us Americans heard the bells chime out, our national anthem. And we all tried to sing, but the words would hardly come out. And then they play taps, and then you're just done. And then you are done. And then you walk around and overlook the beautiful bluff and the beach and the ocean, and you have your moment in the cemetery. And that was one of our days in France. Thanks to the folks from Kelly Cruz and to all of those of you that shared that moment with Brenda and me and my family, because it was a powerful one, and it sure was a bucket list item for a lot of people. So back to Chicago then in the news. The Mincing Rascals will come your way a little after 11 o'clock. We do this pretty swell podcast, and we broadcast part of it on my Saturday show. And the Rascals talk about, among other things, Rod Blagojevich maybe getting out of jail early. It sounds like maybe the president is suddenly less enthusiastic about the idea than he suggested he might be on Air Force One earlier in the week. But the Rascals will be talking a little bit about that. And this Jeffrey Epstein story is bizarre and remarkable, too. Don, I know you're following that in the newsroom as well.
Yes, sir.
He has died by suicide at his Manhattan jail.
That's correct. Yeah, reports that he hanged himself in a cell.
I noticed that the New York Times writes in their headline, Jeffrey Epstein commits suicide in Manhattan. But the USA Today and some others write he died by suicide. I don't know if that's a big difference to you, but I know for families who have been touched by suicide, it really is. And I've been educated this way, that nobody commits to suicide. You die by suicide. It sounds like a subtle difference to you, perhaps, but it means a lot to them. Nobody of sound mind and body would intentionally take their life, goes the thinking. You die by suicide, the same way you might die by cancer or being hit by a car. It's a means of death, but it's not something you personally, willfully would commit to. So they don't like the word commit.
That's interesting. I like that. That's an interesting point. I hadn't heard that, but I will remember that.
The New York Times isn't buying it, evidently, or didn't think about that when somebody wrote the headline, but there is that point, and I noticed it today. The Times said Epstein hanged himself. They quoted officials as saying his body was found at 7:30 in the morning. He's that financier with the opulent homes and the private jet and the access to elite circles, had been dogged for decades by accusations that he paid dozens of girls for sexual acts in Florida. I'm reading now from the New York Times. He previously avoided federal criminal charges in 2008 after prosecutors brokered a widely criticized deal that allowed him to plea to state charges of solicitation of prostitution from a minor. He served 13 months in jail, and even while in custody, Epstein was allowed to leave jail for 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, to work at his office in Florida. Recall previously they found him and they weren't sure if he was assaulted or tried to take his own life, but it looked like maybe he had previously tried to die by suicide.
Right. That's why he was actually on suicide watch when this happened, which is another element to this story that is sort of still being figured out.
Needs some explanation, doesn't it? Because here again, the Times says it's not clear on Saturday whether the authorities had put additional safeguards to watch him after the incident. The Federal Bureau of Prisons hasn't been responding to requests for comments. And you, at first blush, you may say, fine, we're done with him. You know, the world is not wishing that we had another Epstein or even Epstein at all, but it denies justice to a lot of people that this man is no longer alive. And it protects others who may be guilty of other crimes. I mean, he knew things that other people don't. Now, what would he have said? It would be nice to know. And it fuels all sorts of speculation about how he died. Did it look the other way? I don't know.
We had calls suggesting things like that before you even started talking about this. I think that is where I don't want to fuel conspiracy theories necessarily, but there are so many unanswered questions right now, and it's just so ugly. It's just, you feel like you're waking up to the ugliest stories all the time, and you just have to go about your day. There's so much there, and I don't know what we're gonna get out of any of it now.
Well, the New York Times also writes, his acquaintances at various moments included, this is the Times writing, President Trump, Stephen Hawking, Prince Andrew, the Duke of York. They don't mention in here Bill Clinton, but Clinton would be foremost in that sentence, too, for a lot of people. And if this guy's passing now somehow protects those people, you can just imagine what the conspiracy theorists are going to do with all of that.
Yeah. Also worth noting that a massive cache of documents was unsealed just this morning from about 13 years since this case started. So, yeah.
And now we have a lot of the details that we didn't, or will soon have a lot of the details about what he was doing and how he's doing it and how he was pulling it off. And so this man's life is over with a lot of questions remaining. It's 10:21. You'll continue to hear about that this weekend here on WGN Radio. Also, I had to smile at the conversation that Joe and Don were having with Lou Manfredini about the fact that the Field of Dreams is going to be sort of rebuilt for a Major League Baseball game a year from now, the White Sox and the Yankees. And you guys then, and it's inevitable. Field of Dreams then begets the conversation about the movie Field of Dreams, and then the lines and the scenes in the movie.
People will come.
And I'm with Lou. When Burt Lancaster pulled that little girl up and gave her the Heimlich maneuver so she coughed up the hot dog, I was like this. And Dad, You Want to Have a Catch is another one. And then some random scenes where... who plays Kevin Costner's wife in that movie? That's not Amy Adams, is it?
No, it's not. It's she's an Uncle Buck, too. I just looked it up.
There are times where she and Kevin... I thought the movie was really just charming and funny in certain places. And like when she comes to realize what Kevin has seen all along, you just go, oh, Amy Madigan. Thanks, Griffin. You just have these, sort of unexpected surprise warm moments in that movie. But then you say, okay, Field of Dreams. Yeah, I know we got a break. Let's come back and do this. Did you guys do your homework for me? Is it too soon?
I did.
Did it.
Even if you only have the top three, that would work. Favorite sports movies of all time. We don't need to debate them. There's no right or wrong answers here. I just want to know what's on your list. Joe Brand, top three, four, or five sports movies of all time in reverse order. Go.
Number five, Field of Dreams. Number four, The Replacements. Number three, A League of Their Own. Number two, Space Jam. Number one, 61.
Replacements, phenomenal. Oh, 61, also phenomenal.
Space Jam. I know we said we're not going to... You don't have to defend it. We're not going to criticize, but Space Jam.
Ah, great.
Okay, fine.
Such a blending of genres right there.
All right, go, Joe. Don.
I will, top five. Five for me is Happy Gilmore. Four is The Big Green. Three, Rocky IV. Two, The Replacements, Joe. And one, Remember the Titans.
Go, Griff.
We're showing our age. The Replacements came out, we were like 8 or 9, I think, at least for me.
Big part of my youth.
Yeah. Oh, huge.
Yeah, so I was like a teenager, I think.
What was The Replacements about?
It was Keanu Reeves and Gene Hackman. The football players were on strike, so they bring in Falco.
Yes. Yeah. Are you guys serious?
Shane Falco.
But are you guys serious
100%.
About that?
100%.
Have you guys seen more than five sports movies?
I had some honorable mentions on there. I had Dodgeball.
I'm not going to judge or criticize, but really?
It's got the perfect combination of the sports theatrics, a little love interest, and some comedy. It's the perfect movie.
Winners always want the ball when the game's on the line.
That's true.
Did you know that?
That's right.
What are they going to do, throw you in football jail?
Oh, no, now they're quoting that movie.
They need Miles of Heart. Miles and Miles of Heart.
Could you clarify, Griff?
Stop. Just stop.
Number five, The Replacements. Number four, The Replacements. Number three.
Yeah, that's a list.
The Replacements. It's not going to make my top five, actually. Number five, Bend It Like Beckham. Number four, Moneyball. Number three, Bull Durham. Number two, Hoop Dreams. Number one, Little Big League.
Nice. I was thinking about that. That's my number six.
That's not only in your number one sports movie. It would probably be in your five all-time movies
just
list.
Period. Absolutely.
It's on your list, isn't it? And again, that touched you at a time in your life and blah, blah, blah.
It's also holds up. 3.5 out of 4 stars from Roger Ebert at the time.
You know, there's an actor from that movie that works at WGN Radio.
Wait.
What?
League of Their Own here at WGN Radio?
No, Little Big League.
Little Big League.
What did I say?
League of Their Own. Yeah, also great.
Little Big League. Rokan? No, Bill Leff.
Steve Cochran.
Right, no, I did know that.
Bill Leff was
Cochran's listening.
Major
now.
League,
he's
right?
Me. Leff's been in some movies, I know. Was it Major League?
I'm pretty sure Bill Leff was in Major League where the guys are talking about the Indians at the diner. But yeah, Steve Cochran's one of the newspaper reporters interviewing the manager, who's the young boy, who's the main character.
And he made the movie, and that's why it's my number one.
Okay, my number five, Longest Yard, the 1974 Burt Reynolds one. You want to shout out to the old people listening. Number four, Talladega Nights, which I put it on there because that movie makes me laugh so hard, and I don't normally laugh out loud. That movie to me is funnier than Caddyshack. It's not as warmly remembered, but it's funnier than Caddyshack. So that's my five and four. And then my 3, 2, 1, I can't pick one, but they are Moneyball, Hoosiers, and Field of Dreams. Yeah, either one of those in any spot will be fine with me. Can't pick them otherwise.
I feel like we should just mention Bad News Bears.
You got to mention Bad News Bears. Sandlot was hard to leave off.
Oh yeah,
Sandlot. Well, let me just give you five that aren't on this list, but might surprise you if you went back and watched them: Murder Ball, The Wrestler, The Battle of the Sexes, I, Tonya, and Foxcatcher are on a list that Griffin I saw.
Well, directed by Bennett Miller, who made Moneyball.
And Foxcatcher, I thought was really good. Everybody in my family didn't feel that way, but I thought that was a very weird, interesting, good movie.
Also on my list of potential winners, we have to move on, but White Men Can't Jump, which I'd actually like to dedicate the next half hour to convincing you to watch it. He refuses to watch it.
I'm not going
to
watch it.
Unbelievably good movie.
I won't like it. What a stupid title.
You will love it. I know you will. And Raging Bull.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, let's do the news. Don Will. Thank you, Don. John Williams in the Allstate Skyline studio. You know, when I travel, if it's ever, whenever I'm in an airplane and I'm 32,000 feet in the air, and you have that little tab on the screen in front of you that you can click on, and it's My Flight, and then it tells you how high you are and how fast you're going and what the air temperature is outside. I always marvel at the circumstances I find myself in. And I think that gets lost on us so much. Maybe because I hang out with Thomas Jefferson a lot, but do you do that? I almost always on a flight think, I'm in a tube. I'm as high in the air as the peak of Mount Everest. I'm going 600 miles an hour. The temperature outside is 60 degrees below zero. And I'm watching a movie. I mean, it's bizarre that a human being is 5 miles up in the sky or 4 miles, whatever it is, watching a movie and complaining about the wine or that the food is too salty. I mean, we shouldn't even be up there.
You know what I've always found ironic? We move our fastest while sitting down.
Wow, I never thought about it that way either.
Whoa.
Trippy man.
Dude, are you stoned?
What?
Are you? It's not January 1st. Okay.
Save it till next year. The whiplash of going back and forth between those two things. I'll have moments where I realize it, but then it fades, and then you're annoyed about something else. It happens. You try to put yourself in that state, but also if you're nervous about it, you don't want to think about it.
Oh yeah, so, right.
And well, then I go through. I almost feel like I'm like have three states of anxiety or wonder or just
boredom
that you just ping pong back and forth between.
Yeah, because then in the middle of that, there's a little turbulence. And then you think, oh, maybe this isn't so, just about the wine in the movie. Oh, what's going to happen? So then I always watch the airline attendants, whoever's working on that aircraft. And if they're cool with it, then I'm cool with it. They're still walking up and down the thing with coffee. So I'm like, well, if this is really something to be worried about, their first concern wouldn't be coffee for somebody. It would be something else. Yeah, if you see the person that's getting the coffee putting on a parachute, now you know maybe it merits more concern, but you hardly ever see that. And you're sitting there going through the sky, and the flight was like 9 hours long. And I'm like, yeah, but you started in Paris. And then 9 hours later, the door opens and magically you're in Chicago. Especially noteworthy that feeling is when you go from Chicago to, say, Miami or Hawaii in the winter, and then not only have you traveled a great distance in another part of the world, but the door opens and it's 85 or 90 degrees and it's humid. And when you got on, you it was 10 degrees and you just go, man, air flight, that is something else, man. Whoever thought of this, thumbs up, baby. So we almost don't have a place to complain, Would the Apollo astronauts, when they got out of the space trip, go, yeah, but there's no room for my golf clubs. I'm just saying. No, they didn't say that.
I bet they were thinking a little bit about the anxiety of their comfort level getting there. I think it was maybe on their mind a little bit. But they didn't say it. That's true.
Props to them. All right, Walmart has ordered workers to remove video game signs and displays that depict violence from stores nationwide. This is an AP story today. You may have heard about it yesterday, after 22 people died in a shooting at one of its Texas stores. But the big box retailer will continue to sell guns. Walmart will still sell the violent video games and has not made any changes to its gun sales policy. even though workers, politicians, and activists have pressured them to do so. It has stopped selling AR-15s and other semi-automatic weapons in 2015. They said it was weak sales. It wasn't pressure. It wasn't that they didn't want to get involved in the gun conversation. They just said we weren't moving many units. So while they could have sold legally AR-15s, they quit doing that about 4 years ago. You know, Walmart didn't do anything wrong. If you want to sell video games that are violent, I'm not sure that that leads to violent acts. I'm not a fan of video games of any stripe. My kids weren't into them. I wasn't into them. And I don't exactly understand parents who let their kids play violent video games, but that was never a pressure that I encountered. So I'll let you raise your kids the way you want. And I don't think any of us believe that playing violent video games is going to make your kid shoot somebody. So if Walmart wants to sell you and your family a violent video game and you all are cool with that, I don't think Walmart is doing anything wrong. Similarly, if you want to buy a gun and you want to hunt, if you have a legitimate reason to want to have a gun, you ought to be able to find a way to buy it. And Walmart's a store, and they ought to be able to sell it. So Walmart doesn't do anything wrong when they offer to sell guns. After a shooting like this, a week of shootings, a Walmart, I don't think, has to do anything. You know, I think if they had asked me, I would have said, don't do anything. Because a gesture like this, pulling the signs down and some of the store displays, really does look weak. And it almost says, okay, gee, we feel bad about this, so at least we're going to hide the evidence we do it. If they had asked me, I would have said do nothing at all. Now, maybe you think they should stop selling guns of all kind and they should stop selling video games. Maybe you, like me, don't think they should have done anything. I don't know where you are in the continuum of this, but I'd like to know. We'll pause here just a little early so we can get to some of your calls and texts. Tell me what you think about this story. Have you thought about it or talked about it? And what do you think a Walmart, I don't know where else you go, what would be the equivalent of a Walmart? It doesn't even have to be about them per se. But what should Walmart do about this? And did they do anything wrong? I'm interested in where your head is on that part of the story today. 312-981-7200. Call or text now. Hey, Pat, this is John. Thanks for calling. What did you want to say?
Hi, John. I was just listening to your comment. I am traveling up to Chicago right now, so it might be a little bit spotty. But I kind of disagree with the issue that video games do not influence young people. I'm a retired nurse and psychotherapist, and I've worked with a lot of adolescents who have been in and out of hospitals because of psychiatric problems. And I really do feel, and I've read a lot of research about the effect of violent video games on young children. And also about the gun issue in Walmart, two things that I have determined over the last week is I'm going to stop shopping at Walmart or Sam's until they do something about the sale of guns. Dick's Sporting Goods did it. I think Walmart has a responsibility at least to limit their sales of assault weapons to people. That really, really and that's two things that I can do as a parent, as a grandparent. So I raised 6 children, and I have 17 grandchildren, and I strongly urge my children not to have their children exposed to that violence in videos, TV, anything. It really bothers me, that culture of the video game.
Yeah, I got it. Hey, Pat, thank you for the call.
I'm glad. That huge $1 million playing that very violent video game, I think that's so wrong.
Pat, I hear you, and I appreciate your thought on that. Drive safely, and keep listening. We've got more callers coming in, okay? All right. Judy is next. You're on WGN. Judy, jump in there. You're on the air.
Yes. I understand that these are terrible shootings. These should not be happening. However, 30 people a day in the United States die from drunk driving accidents. If the media would project a little bit more of this than the sensationalism of the shootings. Also, there are over 132,000 schools in the United States, and the other day somebody said it was an epidemic of school shootings. If the things would just be put into perspective, I think appreciate it a lot more.
Judy, thanks for the call. And from you, Matt, you're on WGN. Matt, what did you want to say?
First of all, on a lighter note, welcome back, King.
Hey, thank you. Good to be back.
Thank you. You're welcome. Now, on to the more pressing matter. Look, folks, in 1999, I was in fifth grade. I wrote a report on violent video games. I played GoldenEye like a crazy person. I still haven't shot anybody. I would never shoot anybody. Violent video games have been around. They will always be around. The fact of the matter is, if you give a person a gun instead of a knife, they're going to shoot and kill a lot more people than they would have with a knife before somebody can take them down. And the fact that there are people wandering around places with open carry permits, and have the police need to check all these people, which means it delays them from getting to the actual killer. I'm not saying that's what happened here, but there have been documented cases of police not being able to find the right gunman because everybody's got a gun. And this is not a riff on James Coburn and Maverick. Everybody's got a gun. I get it. No, not everybody should be able to get a gun. It's ridiculous. And Walmart is not getting a single cent of my money until they stop selling guns.
I appreciate you listening and calling, Matt. Well done. We hear you loud and clear. We're going from you to Kevin. All right, Kevin is next, Griff. Are we ready on line two? You can text too, 312-981-7200. Hey, Kevin, you're on WGN. Hi.
Hey, John. I'd just like to say I played quite a few of these shooter games. And the one thing that nobody seems to talk about is that they don't. No game teaches you how to hate.
It's an interesting point.
You know, hatred is something that's taught. It's something that you're learned. You're not born hating a group of people. You might be born with fear, but you're not born hating. That's something that someone teaches you to do. Something that's learned. Well, unfortunately.
I got you, my friend. Thanks for the phone call. Thanks for listening. You know, the Mincing Rascals podcast that we recorded yesterday dropped last night. We normally do it Thursdays. I was out of town until Thursday evening, so we did it Friday, and it moved Friday around 5 o'clock. And the gang talked a little bit about this point, too. As much attention was rightfully put on the shootings in Texas and Ohio this week, other people have said, well, what about the 50 or so shootings that seem to be happening every weekend in Chicago? Should those be put in the same box? And I was just entertaining that conversation, and the gang had a lot of very pointed things to say about that. We don't have time for the full podcast here. We like to feature a little of it, and we will after 11 o'clock on the Mincing Rascals podcast broadcast.
And Neil deGrasse Tyson had a tweet to that effect in the aftermath of one of these shootings that was about, you know, the numbers of deaths that are caused by other things and looking at it logically. And I just don't... I mean, especially in that moment, it was not the time. And I don't. People who want to approach this with, hey, you know, use your logical brain. It's like, okay. I don't. You really aren't disturbed by what you see, really?
Right.
Really? It doesn't feel like there's more now, really?
Well,
we had that caller saying something similar, and I understand the point, but. You are not you're not horrified by what's happening. I know that's rude to say. I'm sure she is, but to want to not respond emotionally, I think that's ridiculous. Also, I think looking at Walmart in the aftermath of this, it speaks to how desperate and hopeless we are in our politics, that we are not even considering what they might do, because we know that. I actually think there is some movement here, but just a tiny bit after so long. So I have hope. But the fact that we go to a corporation like this and say, what can you do?
Or you did something wrong. I mean, that's to me, this is, it's almost a non sequitur, isn't it? Walmart didn't do it. Walmart had nothing to do with this. And then Walmart says, okay, we hate the fact that at the same time that we're talking about this, we have guns for sale and violent imagery associated with these video games, so we're going to try and quietly pull it down. Walmart, you can't quietly do anything. But so maybe they handled this clumsily, but Walmart didn't do anything wrong in my mind.
I just see the conversation goes this way because we've seen it go the other way, and it stops because it has nowhere to go. You know, so somebody texted and said they got video games in other countries and they don't have the problems that we have.
I think it is a cultural thing. I mean, it's you can debate amongst yourselves. I'm open to the idea that maybe for some people, violent video games are a trigger mechanism, or it's another layer that doesn't help. But I think it's too easy to put it in that box. There's something else going on in America relative to other countries. We need to pause. It's 10:56. The Mincing Rascals podcast broadcast touches on this briefly, but they spend a lot of time out of the gate talking about what the president is doing and the chance that Rod Blagojevich might be bumping into you in a Starbucks sometime soon. It's time for John Williams to get back to WGN Radio. Thanks to everybody who filled in for me or helped in my absence, including the Saturday show. But I'm back here in the saddle after having spent some time on the road with some listeners. We were in France. Kelly Cruz has arranged a great trip for us all, and it's nice to be back now. By the way, I brought two books with me when I traveled. I always bring the hardbacks, too, which is the dumbest thing to do, but I don't have a working e-reader right now, and I just like having hardback books. So I brought a book about Teddy Roosevelt's Crowded Hour, San Juan Hill, absolutely fascinating. And I brought Sean Spicer's memoir, which is weird because there I was in France, and you know how intimate a book can feel. I sort of felt like I was sharing Paris and the River Seine with Sean Spicer, which is not what I intended to do. I will say this, it's a really well-written book, and I found it really interesting. I did not say I really enjoyed it, but I'm glad that I read it. I mean, I would like to know what that man's insight was and what he felt like when he was saying and doing the things he did.
Is it? How do you think it stacks up in terms of the memoirs of hosts of the TV show Extra? Hollywood correspondents from Extra. Is it one of the best memoirs from them?
I'm not going to answer that question. I don't think it deserves one, Griffin. Okay, so here's the Mincing Rascals podcast broadcast. We do this on Saturdays, you know. Playback part of our award-winning Illinois Broadcasters Association Best Podcast of the Year. Joining the mix today are Eric Cohn. He is with the Illinois Policy Institute. Lisa Donovan, who writes the Spin newsletter for the Chicago Tribune. And then our Justin Kaufman, who hosts Extension 720 on WGN at night. And Steve Bertrand, who does the noontime business lunch on WGN and who does the news on my 1-3 show. So in this segment, we start out talking about Donald Trump said that Rod Blagojevich went to jail for but a single phone call and that he didn't do anything. If he goes to jail at all, the president said, he should not go to jail for that long. About that, Justin Kaufman says,
you can argue the sentence, but I don't think you can argue the fact that he tried to sell the U.S. Senate seat, and that should not be at all diminished, and it seems like that's what the president's doing.
The first thing that always comes to mind is selling the Senate seat. People forget things like he tried to shake down a children's hospital for a campaign contribution.
The pediatric doctors, the reimbursement, has that gone out yet or is that still on hold?
The rate increase?
Yeah.
It's January 1.
And we have total discretion over it?
Yep.
We could pull it back if we needed to. Budgetary concerns, right?
We sure could. Yep.
Okay. Good to know.
Yep.
Which, if selling the Senate seat is gross, that's truly grotesque. But what sticks out to me is exactly what you talked about. You have Patty Blagojevich lobbying in to get her commutation for her husband. It makes, to me, think that people will be more cynical about our system of justice. That if you have prestige, fame, you've been on a television show with the President of the United States, one thing can happen to you. People put away for drug crimes that they probably shouldn't be put away for continue to languish in prison. And it gives people this view that there's two types of justice in America, and that's not healthy.
I think we're going into this 2020 election. He's kind of at the precipice of something here. Either he's going to zoom or he's going to sink. And I think he is trying to make the case that, hey, this Justice Department, no matter who's in charge of it, is terrible. I also think that you have somebody who is trying to distract. It's just what you said.
He makes things up. You know, he blamed Blagojevich's conviction and prosecution on James Comey.
And that's, on a single call.
And that's not a small thing. James Comey was not Robert Mueller, he could have picked Mueller, he hates him too, was the director of the FBI during the investigation and during the prosecution.
Props to Patty at least, right? I mean, none of this matters to Patty Blagojevich. She wants to get her husband home to be with their daughters. And she's been playing
right
masterfully.
This is so dangerous because it allows the FBI and power-hungry, overzealous prosecutors like Patrick Fitzgerald to go after anyone that they don't like.
You got to admit that's been working.
And that's the alarming thing, that the way to get policy or any kind of changes to happen is to get on Fox and Friends and get in the president's ear. Mm-hmm. There's something, I think, alarming to me about all of that. Going back, there are even things that I'd forgotten about, that, you know, what kicked off the whole investigation was basically Dick Mell yes. mouthing off because Rod Blagojevich wouldn't hire the people he wanted him to hire and give business to the people he wanted him to give business
to. It's still my favorite quote of all time, when they put it on the splash on the front of the Sun-Times and said, "You drove a stake through my heart." That's what Dick mm-hmm. Mell said about Rod Blagojevich when they're talking about, I think we're talking about the garbage dump. A great Chicago politics
quote.
Go back
and listen to some of the archived audio, the scheming voice that Blago has, and all of the people that are playing into his scheme. I mean, J.B. Pritzker is probably wishing this story didn't happen right now, because he makes some cameos, too.
I actually am calling you about, I think you appoint his replacement, don't you?
Oh, interesting. Let's think about that. You interested in that?
That's the one I would want.
Now, here's, how about this scenario?
It makes a lot of sense.
Listen. You extremely open minded on that thing, but don't rule yourself out completely on that Senate thing.
And he was where at the fair yesterday, the kickoff of the fair, and was saying, you know, he needs to, you know, Rod Blagojevich needs to serve out his term. My friend, who,
there's an AG I can appoint. JB, are you a lawyer?
Yeah.
There's an AG that I appoint.
Oh, that's it.
You see what I'm saying?
Don't rule that out. I won't rule that out. Right. Which is, I think, to the point that the president was trying to make. That was just braggadocio, or whatever you, however you pronounce it. It was just him scheming and thinking, is that a crime? Should he go to jail for that?
Trump hasn't had a thought below the surface about this. He couldn't tell you who convicted him or what he was convicted for. And, you know, and another thing, if I can segue a little bit, because of this idea, this Trump plan of just making things up, that too many people in this country are willing to believe because they say it. Ivanka Trump did it this week as well mm-hmm. in Chicago. And John, I don't know if you're aware, there was a very violent weekend in Chicago. There were mm-hmm. 52 people shot,
seven.
And she tweeted out, "Let's not forget the violence in the inner cities where seven people were killed, 52 injured near a playground in Chicago."
I think she had the numbers wrong, too.
She had the numbers wrong. She had the spot wrong. But she did it. She implied that it was a single shooting.
This is where I love Mayor Lightfoot, in the way that she doesn't mince words.
She got the numbers wrong. She got the location wrong. That's the danger of trying to govern via tweet. That's the danger of somebody with a platform and audience that time that doesn't know what they're talking about, that they could easily figure out if they wanted to be a constructive and engaged partner.
You said it was playground. It wasn't playground. It was Douglas Park.
And not only was it Douglas Park, it was all over the city.
Yeah.
I mean, those were the city totals. But she tweeted as if it was one attack.
She made it seem, she, you know, just kind of put a tweet out, made it seem like it was 52 people.
I know Lisa has a point, but I just have to say, Lisa, that she also used the word mustn't, which I don't think we should ever do in a tweet.
Lightfoot has been taking off on President Trump, and it almost looked like Ivanka was coming in here, tweeting this thing out, kind of making Lori Lightfoot, you know, look like she doesn't know how to control crime. So don't go after my dad about gun control.
Yeah.
There was sort of a little bit of a side slap there to kind of put her, seemingly to put her in her place.
I'm going to guess that that's something that Mayor Lightfoot is not unhappy she said out loud.
Oh, no.
What's annoying, color me shocked that Ivanka Trump has a thumbless grasp of the crime and gun violence problem in Chicago.
Okay, but
I don't think that's surprising.
But when I was in France, we're all mm-hmm. trying to escape the world, right? And we're looking at headlines on our phones and then turning them off. And one of the headlines I saw was, should we consider the weekend violence that we regularly allow, you know, that we sort of accept, that's the reality of Chicago. Should it be in the same box as what happened in Texas or Ohio?
We talked about this a little bit last night on Extension 720, but this concept that there is a difference. And it's almost, and I hate to put it this way because it comes across crass, but this idea, it's a gang war in Chicago that is causing most of the violence on the streets. So usually it's targeted. Don't get me wrong, there are going to be times when people are caught in a crossfire, and we see that. And Chicago and the nation reacts accordingly when it's an innocent victim who's underage. That's the sort of byproduct of war. What's happening on the streets of Chicago is war. Terrorism is what's happening when it comes to mass shooting, where someone goes into a place of business or other places to kill innocent people.
I think that's a really important point, because you have, because of the commonality of the device that is used to commit the violent act, we're talking about these things as if they are the same. They're not the same. They're in different buckets. They need to be dealt with in different ways. And it's the kind of whataboutism that you get of when these mass shootings happen, horrible, awful that you get this. Well, what about the violence in Chicago? Okay, we can have both of those conversations, but we're talking about fundamentally different
things.
But
they're not the same conversation.
They're not the same conversation.
But they're still young people that are being killed, and I don't know how to characterize these combatants in the war you're talking about, Justin.
You have the national headline of mass shooting, 20 people killed and 50 injured, and then you have a weekend where it's 7 people killed in Chicago. You have to think about sort of the refrain of that. Sort of, we had these big national stories because of these big national horrible events, and then the afterthought is, what about Chicago? And there's a socioeconomic thing, a race thing here, and you can't deny that, because we should have the same reaction. I mean,
or empathy or sympathy, but we don't. Those are such marginalized people.
Not empathy, not sympathy, just sympathy. It's got to be action.
Go ahead, start there.
Yeah. I think Justin's about to speak for me. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead, buddy. I would never speak for Steve.
No, but they are different, and so I think our reactions would be different. I mean, look, my daughter went to the University of Dayton, and her favorite bar was mentioned by this guy as a possible target one time. Well, it's hard to use the right words, because I don't want to imply that the victims in Chicago aren't innocent, but
Justin's point.
Some of the victims are innocent,
and that's the crossfire, and I think that there's an appropriate amount of indignation when that happens. But when you're talking about two rival cliques in Inglewood, and one of the kids rolls up on a bike and he shoots up a porch.
I understand.
It's terrible.
That.
It's okay. Everything in there. But different than a guy putting on body armor and saying, I want to get out, I'm going to walk into Walmart.
I want to have that other conversation for just a second, which is that if that kid's 15 or 16, I think, how did that kid get there? Yeah. And we all just say, he's a bad kid.
Absolutely.
That's exactly what Eric was saying. That's a conversation.
We need to have that conversation,
but it's not the same one.
But it's the one I wanted to have. That's Steve Bertrand and Justin Kaufman, and then two other voices that you might not recognize if you're a regular listener to the Mincing Rascals. And we appreciate both of them joining the mix as well. In fact, let's pause for a second and then just pick it up with one other little piece, which I thought was very interesting. And again, we didn't all agree on the same question or answer. And that is, if you were the king of your town, would you want, starting January 1st, your town to sell marijuana? Some towns are saying no. Naperville said no. Elgin and Elburn, another town that started with an E in the Chicagoland area, have said yes. Towns are deciding, because they can, will our municipality allow retail sales of recreational marijuana? So I said, you're the king of your town. What are you going to do? After this on WGN. 11:24, 25 now. News in about 5 minutes. Real quick, just another part of the Mincing Rascals podcast broadcast. Here the gang is talking about, if you were the king of your town, would you want retail pot sales? Would you want a store in your town? The towns in Illinois are all lining up, deciding if they're going to allow it or not. Justin Kaufman goes first.
I don't understand it. It's legal now. And I feel like if I were running a town, I would want to bring that kind of business and that kind of revenue to and that kind of convenience to my town.
So Justin Kaufmanville has...
Yay!
Eric?
I would agree with that as well. And be clear, the Illinois Policy Institute does not have to take a position on this. But if I'm now king of my town, I grew up downstate
where?
In Belleville.
Belleville?
I just tend to agree with what was just said, that you're probably going to want the revenue. I think a bigger point to all of this is, if it's going to be allowed as point of sale in Naperville or not in Naperville, people who from Naperville who want to acquire it are still going to go acquire it. It's my hope that the revenue is put towards something that we actually need to address in this state, like, say, maybe the pension problem.
I agree with you. We need the money. Set it up on every
this
block.
This is so gross, though, isn't it? Okay,
I know. Chicago will change.
What if we didn't need the money? What if we were Minnesota and we had a surplus? That's the state of Minnesota. But suppose Chicago and Illinois didn't have the budgetary problems they do. Would your opinions about this change?
I think the revenue is the weakest argument in favor of changing the marijuana laws as they existed. If you were to go back in time and tell people, describe the effects of people smoking marijuana, and then describe the effects of people drinking alcohol, and say, in the future, one of these two is illegal and the other is not, would anybody guess that it would be marijuana that's illegal?
I don't think we really know what the ultimate repercussions are going to be of recreational marijuana.
So I don't understand what you mean. We're not going to know the repercussions.
Not that long.
Go to California.
I don't know.
It is not, when I'm in California and it's not what I think about,
It's not like I'm like, oh, man, the day of marijuana is legal here. It doesn't matter. At a certain point, it's just another storefront, and you're into it or you're not into it, and it doesn't. There's not a prevailing culture. It's not like it's going to turn into idiocracy here.
I was visiting my daughter, and I was like day three into it. I'm like, oh, damn, I completely forgot.
It's just another business in town. I don't think, and frankly, I think there's a little stereotype too. This idea that it's some sort of I got to get buzzed in, and it's a scourge to your community. These places are sweet. The one in Naperville, if they let it in Naperville, will be all white counters, real nice, get what you want.
Where the buds are curated.
Yeah, the buds are curated. The bud tender comes over, can I get something for you? It'll be better than half of the businesses
I
don't get it.
Noah went to one in Washington, and he talked about the hints of cherry and the wood burning and all right. of this stuff. Okay. You know, it's like,
right. And the liquor stores. It's like wine culture.
I think the issue that's going to come up. But beyond just selling, and I think the issue that's going to come up is in the workplace. I have family in Colorado and Washington, and I've heard stories from them. One, like, moved from a sort of a regular job to a management gig, and, you know, had somebody sort of blazing up in their car at noon, and then coming back in, and there really weren't.
Or if you're doing chewables or edibles, and
right.
that's less detected.
Right.
I want my town to be Lyle, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to line the border of Naperville with pot shops. That's what I'm going to do.
Be the fireworks of Indiana,
exactly.
In other words.
You bet.
Okay, but I just for the record, so when they play back this in the time capsule, at least one voice will have said, I'm not sure that we really have a handle on developing brains about adolescents who aren't legal, but they're close enough to it that they're going to have access to it. And the only reason that we all have this flip attitude about it is because at the end of the day, the states and the municipalities need money. It's gross to me, the fact that the state is encouraging these kind of behaviors.
What's missing in that argument is to act as if this is brand new. Kids have been smoking weed.
It's brand new for the state to start cashing in on it.
Just legalize cashing in on it.
The state wasn't cashing in before. We're endorsing it as a state.
I agree with you that some of the rationale that we use for it is entirely gross. However, I think there's an important point to be made and something to remember, that just because something is legal doesn't mean that we believe it to be moral or honorable. And there's a full cultural element to all of that. That's like, would I encourage my children to smoke marijuana? No, I would not. Does that mean that I want the state empowered to arrest people and put them in jail if they choose to do those kinds of things? I don't want that either.
He's the king of my town, too.
Chief of police of his town, Jack.
You can have Justin Town.
That's an interesting point that was made by Eric Cohn from the Illinois Policy Institute. The other voice you heard there was Lisa Donovan, author of the Spin newsletter for the Chicago Tribune, and then Justin Kaufman, who was banging heads with me and Steve Bertrand from WGN Radio.
Another 100 people just got off of the train and came up through the ground, while another 100 people just got off of the bus and are looking around at another 100 people who got off of the plane and are looking at us who got off of the train and the plane and the bus maybe yesterday. It's a city of strangers. Some come to work, some to play.
Eight. Okay, Griff, this is a little bit of a surprise. Saturdays, about this time, Griffin usually introduces us to a piece of music. We rate it on our Vibe Score segment, where we score things in the news on a scale of 1 to 100, but usually you're playing somebody playing at Lollapalooza or somebody on the charts, or what was that?
That was Pamela Myers singing a song from the musical Company, 1970. The song's called Another 100 People. Now,
love that song.
She's not performing at Lollapalooza, or didn't perform last weekend at Lollapalooza.
All right.
I'm playing it because legendary theater director and producer Hal Prince died last week. And actually, this song links a couple of notable deaths in the past week, and I'll get to the other one in a second. But Hal Prince worked with Stephen Sondheim through the 60s and 70s, producing things like West Side Story, and Sweeney Todd were their two biggest hits together, probably, or at least looking back. They also did a little Night Music, and that was my personal favorite, Company, in 1970. And then they stopped working together in the 80s, and when he went on to produce the Phantom of the Opera, probably the biggest success in Broadway history. He also directed Cabaret in 1966 as well. So just a titanic figure in the history of of musical theater. And rest in peace.
You're a big Sondheim fan, too, aren't you?
I am, yes.
I knew that was, when that popped up, I said, oh, now we know why Griff's playing this.
But you can't love Sondheim as I do, and we valorize him for writing all the music, and that's truly what I love. But he worked so closely with Hal Prince for so long on so many historic shows, so you have to
pay your
respect.
What was the TV series about Cabaret?
That was Fosse Verdon. That just came out. I think Hal Prince must have popped up somewhere in there in some fictionalized version, yeah.
Fosse. And what did you think of that? Did you watch that? Did you see that?
I watched the first few, and I really liked it. But I just, it's so rare that I keep up with any show. But yeah. I do want to finish that at some point,
It's a good series, yeah, yeah. So, okay, so we got that going for us.
So then also, there was a legendary documentary filmmaker named D.A. Panabaker. He made Don't Look Back, the Bob Dylan documentary from the 60s. He chronicled Monterey Pop Festival. He made The War Room about the Clinton campaign in 93. He also died this past weekend, or this past week. And he also made a documentary about the filming. They filmed the cast recording of the musical Company that I just played from. So they were together in the making of that documentary in 1970, and both passed away this past week.
Yeah, yeah, fair enough to note that, Griff. I don't know if we got something to score there, but...
Did you like the song?
That City of Strangers song, I've heard that.
It's called
that
Another 100 People. Yeah.
I love that.
It's my favorite song from Company, which is probably my favorite musical.
It's the song you're not going to just stumble upon either. Now we're all going to have to go tell ALEXA to play that for us. So the title of the song, one more time, is...
Another 100 People from Company.
Yeah. That I give 92 to. Joe, do you know that song well enough? Did you get a good enough feel for it to give her a score?
It's funny you bring that up, because I really don't like rating songs from musicals where I just take them out of context. I feel like you got to be there, you got to be at the musical, because those people are so talented, and it's just such a different environment when you watch the musical live rather than just listening to it back.
Yeah.
In fact, even when I've gone to see a musical, and then I listen to the songs after, I remember the emotions and remember what I thought when I actually watched it live. So, and obviously there's a lot of talent there. I can't really say I enjoyed or didn't enjoy the song.
So you give it 100 then?
Sure, of course. But
it's okay, because that's what's so interesting about the movie that's made about the recording of this cast album that recording is from. It's called Company Cast Recording. And the anxiety that goes into trying to recreate what they do on stage every night, and this is going to be the one lasting document of it. People are stressed and angry at each other, and it's sort of painful to watch, but it's really entertaining too.
Yeah. Name of that movie again is
Company Cast Recording.
Company Don, Cast Recording. Weapon, go.
30. I say 30. It gave me anxiety listening to all those people pouring out of whatever.
So my 100
vehicle
is now bumped up to 130 to offset that.
Just
to I love that
root
song
for your team.
Fair enough.
Can I ask you guys this one? I think this is a very good one. Ron Burgundy did, what was it, 6 TV shows the other night? He made an appearance on a bunch of the late-night TV talk shows. And I like the movie and I like the star, but I never think his shtick is that funny. If you said 1 to 100, how funny is Ron Burgundy just riffing? I'm like a 62 on that. I feel like I'm an outlier, but I don't find myself laughing at his
I'm sorry, I was away for just a second.
Sure.
So we're talking about Anchorman?
Well, not the movie, but Ron Burgundy made a cameo on a bunch of TV shows the other night.
Oh,
he does this all the time. He'll do color or play-by-play of a game on a network or something like that.
He has a podcast now that he does that character.
I think it's thin. I mean, for me, I just never find myself laughing that hard at it. I think it's a great bit, but I never don't find it that funny. 1 to 100, 62, Ron Burgundy. The character, Griffin, go.
Yeah, in the right context, there's really nothing better. And actually, I'd say even funnier than the movie itself is the blooper reels, Anchorman blooper reels. I love blooper reels in general for things that are funny. Sometimes you get a bad one, but I love them so much. And Anchorman has pretty historically hilarious blooper reels that you can find on YouTube. So my affection for those is so great that I have to be up 90. I didn't see the things that you're talking about.
Yeah.
My guess is that I probably wouldn't have enjoyed it as much, but no.
Where are you, Brand?
Can't do it. 90.
I'm around you. I'm with a 60. I hate being the guy that says, oh, they never should have made a sequel, but you're right. It's just such an overplayed thing. And obviously, Will Ferrell is a talented, hysterical, and one of the funniest guys of our generation.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It almost seems like every one of his characters are the same. This overconfident, quirky guy that, you know, isn't going to take no from anybody. Like, that's why I love his role in Elf, because it's such a different character that he plays.
Yeah, Step Brothers, too. I feel like, you know, it's different than that character you guys
are
talking about.
Yeah, I mean, to a Talladega Nights, and then what's the basketball one?
Hoop Dreams or whatever. What is it?
Not Hoop Dreams.
Not Hoop Dreams.
Semi-pro.
Semi-pro.
Oh,
thank you. Yeah. Anchorman. You know, they're all the same. This very...
Ron Burgundy was in Hoop Dreams?
It's like I missed it.
No, but here's what happens with somebody
whoever
like
whoever was on, like, local Chicago news, TV news at the time was probably not that far from Ron Burgundy.
No, I know. It's a good parody. But, I mean, so you're so anticipating it's going to be so funny. I find people around that character giving more than they're getting because they're just like, it's Ron Burgundy. It's going to be so awesome. And it's not that awesome. People laugh harder than it is funny.
That's what I was thinking with Anchorman is it's like the I end up when I think of fondly of like the funniest moments of that movie, I'm usually thinking of like other characters' lines or sort of like the ensemble around him.
Yeah, you want to be in that room, but is he really being that funny right now? Not so much.
He may be experiencing Will Ferrell fatigue here, just in general, I think, is what's feeding into
what
this.
What can I take for that?
Maybe I have the remedy here. No, but I will try to combat it and just say he's one of the greatest. He's made a lot of bad movies. It's true. It happens to every...
Yeah, I was going to say, doesn't it happen to...
It happens to every comedy star. That's kind of the name of the game. The ones that he's written and had a essential, like... role in shaping.
Yeah.
That he made a lot of them with Adam McKay, who's left comedy to do these not very good movies. Hot take, but that's how I feel.
Zing.
Just throwing that out there.
I just think he should have stayed. Stick to sports, Joe, and Adam McKay stick to comedies. But the ones they made together are unimpeachable. Anchorman, Talladega Nights, Step Brothers, and even the other guys I think is fantastic.
I'm going to watch Talladega Nights this weekend.
You're really on it right now.
I really am.
And he's just one of the maybe the best SNL cast member of all time.
Yes.
I think. So I just don't. I don't know. I give him a lot of leeway, I guess. Is what I
but
guess
but we're not ranking Will Ferrell.
That's
here.
It. You're giving right. more than you're getting when.
Yeah, but
when
I still the character's
candles.
Part of it though. I say go off, do whatever you want. God
okay.
bless.
Okay. God bless.
Yeah. I'll give it a 75 only because I am factoring in Will Ferrell, non-character, just riffing and his improbability and like how great he is with that. But
Your Honor, I don't believe that the witness is answering the question.
All right, 60.
He's filibustering.
Filibustering.
You won't rest till you get the score you want, sir.
That's right.
How dare you?
Being treated as hostile.
Let me throw one more at you guys. Pot store in your town. I asked the Mincing Rascals, if you were king of your town, would you want a pot store there? I am a 69 on a pot store in my town. I'm not sure I want it. Joe, will there be a pot store in Joe Branville?
Yes, I'm okay with it.
You get the tax revenue, and it's convenient for your citizens. So you're going to cash in on pot sales in your town. Joe Brand, that's, what did you give it, Joey?
Give me a 90, 94.
94, re-elect Joe Brand. Don Kleppen.
99, bring
Griffin,
it.
Griffin, where are you?
Yeah, 90s.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
All bring right, the enough. Green.
You know, you were gone the weekend after Once Upon a Time in Hollywood came out.
Oh, yeah,
do we have
right.
a score for the latest Quentin Tarantino movie?
You saw it, I saw it. Do you guys see Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
Not yet, no.
I did not.
Where are you on this, Griff?
87.
Oh!
88.
Wow, look at that.
I really enjoyed it.
Explain yourself. Why not higher?
There's just so much packed into it. It's a long movie, and there's a lot happening, and I loved a lot of it, and some of it I didn't love.
How much of the score is predicated on the last scene?
Well, you have to take it into account. We won't spoil anything.
Nope.
But
nope.
That was... coming out of it the first time, I didn't like or dislike it necessarily.
Oh, you've seen it twice,
haven't
you?
I was head scratching after that one.
Okay.
Now looking back on it, I kind of love the fact that it's such a head scratcher. So,
okay, fine.
What about you?
I was cruising along at a 90 and then fell back to about an 85 on a 2, I think, because I thought that last. It's not the same, but I watched Vice on the airplane. You know, the movie about Dick Cheney with all of those great
The one that I was just hating
Adam
on,
McKay,
yeah.
yeah.
And I'm telling you, I thought that was a really enjoyable movie. And then the last scene killed it. And I walked out of there going, I didn't walk out of there. I was in an airplane. But when the movie was over, I was like, It just ruined it for me.
You hated it that much, you walked right off that airplane.
I'm out.
William's out.
That's a bad movie. That's a bad one.
All right, we're out of time. Thank you, boys. 11:50. Just saw Amy Guth stroll through the producer bay. We'll find out what's coming up on her show. By the way, Joel Brand, I didn't ask you to vibe something that you had in mind, but what's on your mind over there?
No, it's cool. We don't have to vibe the Little League World Series, but we got to give a mention to the River Forest team. They're playing in the Great Lakes Championship game, or rather the championship game of the Great Lakes Region Tournament. They're taking on Bowling Green. If they win, they're heading to Williamsport, heading to that Little League World Series tournament. So good luck to those 12 and under baseball and softball all-stars.
It's going to be on TV?
I believe so. Yes, it'll be on the mothership, the big four-letter place. You know what I'm talking about.
No, I don't. Be on.
I believe it's ESPN.
Oh, ESPN. Yeah. Well, the Little League World Series is, but is their game?
Oh, where geographically? Westfield, Indiana.
So, but will it be on TV? No, but I mean, I know they broadcast the World Series.
Right. This game today will be on ESPN.
Got it.
4 p.m.
The fence needs to be moved back.
The ball's juice, too.
Well, the kids are. They're just like these. Like, when you hit a home run in the major leagues, you might hit it 10, 15. You know, might hit a gigantic home run and it's 50 feet over the fence. These kids will hit it 75 feet over the fence. Some of them are just bruisers.
You know what?
Just a thought.
They took all the Little League fans into account and said, you know what? You know what sells tickets?
Yeah.
75-foot home runs in Little League games. So that's what we got.
Amy Guth, do you have an opinion about this?
I mean, I love watching it, though, but I think it's like it's so sweet and emotional because they're just little kids, and you have to keep that spirit as you're watching it because you don't want to be one of those
I'm torn every year.
Adult watcher. Yeah, right. No, you're like, oh, it's sports. I'm rooting for this outcome. But you're like, oh, it's kids. You want them to enjoy themselves.
And the kids are crying.
I know.
Sometimes.
When they cry, I can't. Oh, that kills me.
Will, the whole planet's watching. You're on TV.
It's
you're
a lot
on
of pressure.
ESPN, and it's like, I don't know how to fix that either. You want to watch it and hooray for the kids.
The Minnesota-Iowa game is on right now, and I realized that they have replay.
Oh.
I thought that was a little eccentric, but you know what? It's probably better that they have that. That way the coaches can't get really ticked off about something and make...
They're using instant replay on the Little League World
Series? Yes, they are.
Yeah.
Welcome to the future.
Yeah, no kidding. I don't even like it in the major league,
so I know.
I don't know if I like it there.
Right.
Although, actually, I think the umpiring is worse at the Little League level than it is at the professional level. They probably need it more for Little League games.
That's probably fair.
But then we're making them even more important than they are. Anyway, what are you doing today?
Well, nothing about Little League, but I am going to talk about the Mariano grocery store chain. So as it sold off to Kroger, as that became its parent company, slowly but surely some changes started to come into the Mariano stores, and not all consumers love them.
This is ongoing right now?
Changes? Yeah, it's ongoing as they've been going. So a Bloomberg intelligence analyst kind of took a look at that and said, hey, you know, this was a Whole Foods competitor. If we bring it too much into the Kroger brand, you might lose some of that higher end shopper value, all that kind of stuff. Take a look at that. And also about a piece that's really interesting that's also at Bloomberg that is about how actually the Android, not the iPhone, shaped so much of the technological age that we're in right now. So we're going to talk all about that.
I think, I don't know that this is true. Maybe you do or don't know. More people on the planet use Androids than iOS, than iPhones, right? Griff is shaking his head.
Yeah, it's a lot more.
No, I'm nodding.
Yeah, pardon me, Griffin.
Yeah,
agrees.
Yeah,
that's true.
Good, because I was like, wait a minute, Griffin, that's not right. No, it's a more accessible phone worldwide, and so therefore, yeah, it does have a lot of users. It has a lot more users,
yeah.
Even though it seems like iPhone has that brand share where we think about when an app comes out, they always usually come out with the iPhone version of it first, but and then follow with an Android app.
President uses an iPhone, right?
Oh, I can't keep up with him. I'm not sure. I'm sure he does.
I mean, who is the most famous phone user in the world? It's Donald
certainly,
Trump.
Certainly. Yeah.
And I think he has, or his staff has, the iPhone.
We'll have to look at the bottom of his tweets, because it would just say, sent by iPhone.
Yeah. Remember, the big thing with Obama was how long he held on to his BlackBerry.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, he did not want to let that go.
Boy, that's old school.
R.I.P. the BlackBerry.
Yeah. By the way, so does this mean that the Marianos are maybe not going to have people pushing carts around with glasses of Chardonnay in their hand?
Well,
is that
that's
going to stay?
Part of it is that, like, that dining-in experience, and that there was bars and espresso counters, things like that. And those are kind of going away in favor of, like, self-checkout and things like that that are more affiliated with the Kroger brand. So, but really, it's kind of a bigger bigger conversation in the grocery industry right now, because as soon as Amazon bought Whole Foods, suddenly the game changed a lot, and a lot of grocers knew they had to step up and change things in order to compete. And so here's the Kroger brand, who has had a lot of discount brands kind of pulling Mariano's, by some estimations, pulling it down in quality. So yeah, we'll take a look at that.
Don't need up too much of your time. We'll pause here. One quick commercial break, then Amy will introduce the news, and then she'll get rolling on WGN.